Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Internet was born and raised in the USA, but now, says our guest tonight, its highest and best use is migrating abroad to countries like Japan and South Korea, where many more users have much faster broadband connections. The results for the U.S. economy, he says, could be disastrous. Tonight on Point, a warning for the U.S. in the slow lane online. But first, we begin tonight with an update from Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, where a U.S. Marine is fighting for his life in a case that has received international attention. Military hearings began today in the case of Second Lieutenant Ilario Pantano, who could face the death penalty for the alleged premeditated murder of two unarmed Iraqi detainees. Pantano is the only member of the Marine Corps to date accused of a capital crime in the Iraq War. A Gulf War veteran and father of two, Pantano maintains the detainees were about to attack him and that he acted in self-defense, but Marine Corps reports suggest Pantano executed the men. Joining us now is John DeSantis, a Wilmington Star news reporter who broke the story and is covering the proceedings for the New York Times. John DeSantis, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before you give us the details of what happened in Iraq, describe for us who is Ilario Pantano.
Ilario Pantano is a U.S. Marine Corps second lieutenant who is 33 years old. He served during the first Gulf War. Grew up in New York, joined the Marine Corps at a young age. After the Gulf War, he attended classes at New York University, went on to work for an investment banking firm.
Goldman Sachs?
Goldman Sachs, that's correct. Went on to involve himself with some new media ventures. And then after the events of September 11, 2001, he attempted to join the Marine Corps once again. He was successful in doing so, ended up a second lieutenant after officer candidate school, and in 2004, with the 2nd Marine, 2nd Battalion, was in Iraq as a platoon leader.
So this is a go-getter, came up out of the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood, but went to Horace Mann, NYU, was at Goldman Sachs, and then back in Iraq. Where and when did the incident in question take place, John?
On April 15th, 2004, near the Iraqi city of Mamadiya. He was part of he was leading a quick response unit that was sent to check, as near as we know at this point, on possible insurgent activity and to search a home that was located near a bridge.
And what happened, or what is alleged to have happened? There clearly are at least two stories here.
Actually, there's only been one story. There's been one story which has come mostly from the defense, and actually the greatest details to date, at least until today's hearing, have come from Lieutenant Pantano's own statement, which he gave to investigators when they were first looking into this. According to Lieutenant Pantano's statement, which we have on our website, we have a copy of it, he had said that he had questioned these two men who were in a car that was that he said was fleeing this house. The car was stopped. The men were taken out and questioned. They were handcuffed as detainees. He believed they were possibly insurgents. The car was searched twice by a Navy corpsman who was part of Lieutenant Pantano's group. And then Lieutenant Pantano said he had the men unhandcuffed and had them both search the vehicle themselves. According to his statement, that was when they made what he perceived as a he doesn't say he perceived it. He says it was
yes.
A threatening move. He feared for his life, and he opened fire. He acknowledged in the statement that he went through two magazines of an M16 rifle, firing anywhere possibly from 40 to 50 rounds of ammunition, and the men were dead.
So he really cut loose. He was cleared in the field, but now he's in a hearing today. What's the history of this case? How did it come to this point?
He was cleared, according to the defense, in a field investigation that was conducted. However, there was another investigation that was initiated, and Navy CIS, the Navy Criminal Investigative Service, began looking into it, we believe at the request of a commanding officer. And at this point, the Marine Corps is having an Article 32 proceeding. This is not a court-martial. This is a proceeding where the prosecutors lay out their what evidence they have. They present what witnesses they have. A hearing officer, in this case a major, decides whether the case to him has merit. And he then makes a recommendation to a general as to what should occur.
John, we're going to have to follow this case to see what happens, but out of all the interactions of American soldiers and Iraqis, this is the first capital charge along these lines, and the death penalty, a possibility if it goes forward. Why this case? Do you have a sense of what's going on here, especially after the report of having been cleared in the field? What's brought this to such a focus?
The prosecution, although they're not telling us exactly where they're going with it, presented witnesses today who gave details that were additional details, and we can't really know how to evaluate those yet, although we do know that one corporal who testified today, who was a translator, said that the two men were found with their on their knees, shot in the back, according to him. Something that he said when he saw them that he thought was odd. There are other things involving this case, such as a sign that was placed above the car where the two men were found dead that said, "No better friend, no worse enemy." And that was a reference to something that testimony today indicated was very often said to Iraqis to keep them from joining the insurgency.
Well, it's become a kind of cause celeb. We're going to have to follow it. Thanks very much for being with us tonight, John.
Thank you so very much.
John DeSantis, a reporter for the Wilmington Star News. He spoke with us from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. The economic promise of the Internet is ultimately about how many people can use it, how fast. The transformational promise of the net is deeply linked to high-speed broadband access and all the services and applications that makes possible. A few short years ago, the U.S. was a leader in broadband usage. Now it's fallen behind. My guest tonight says South Korea, Japan, and others are claiming the high-speed frontier and will claim its riches, too. Skeptics say that's techno-alarmism, but the stakes are unquestionably high. This hour, On Point, a warning that the U.S. is falling behind in a very consequential arena of speed, broadband, Internet access. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you know that the U.S. now ranks behind Japan and South Korea and about a dozen others in broadband Internet use? Do you see the consequences? How much do they matter for America's technological and economic future? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Blea, a former U.S. Foreign Service officer in Japan for 8 years. He's completing a book on the race for Internet leadership. His piece in the current issue of Foreign Affairs is Down to the Wire. Thomas Blea, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
So you're sending up a warning tonight, and at the heart of it, it's all about speed. What's happening?
Well, basically, we have dial-up Internet and what I call basic broadband. I think a good analogy would be to say that we have gravel roads and maybe asphalt roads. But in Asia, for about the same price, they're using two-way concrete state highways and interstate highways, and it's quite a difference.
We're going to get into a lot of the detail on this tonight, Thomas Blea, but what are the consequences that you see? I mean, some people have faster internet access, some have slower, but you're describing this in very large economic and technological leadership terms. Why so consequential?
Well, because I believe it at each of these stages, there is a commercial market. First of all, habits change. Even with our relatively slow internet, we spend about 60% more time if we have a broadband connection than we would if we have a dial-up connection, which means that we do more, we spend more money. There has only been one good economic estimate that I'm aware of that was done in 2001 by a Brookings economist named Robert Crandall. And he estimated that if we had universal broadband, the slow basic broadband that we now are familiar with, but if we had it throughout the country, it could add as much as $500 billion a year and 1.2 million jobs over time. Now, that's a guess, and it was done almost 4 years ago. It's not a guess. I mean, he went through an economic methodology. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult thing to estimate, but it's quite clear that hundreds of billions of dollars are at stake, and over time, hundreds of thousands of high-tech jobs.
And as you describe it, technological leadership, because the applications that are going to be at the forefront are going to be developed where people are using the web at high speed.
I think that's right. As information spreads around the world and as these high-speed connections proliferate, I think we will be getting innovation from a lot of different points in the world. We're seeing it coming out of India now, out of China. But those with the biggest connections or the fastest roads will have the first advantage, I think.
Thomas Blea, stand by. There's a lot more we want to hear and learn tonight. We're glad you're with us. We're talking about a warning that the United States has fallen behind in broadband internet access with economic implications that could be huge. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you know that the U.S. has fallen to 13th globally in broadband usage? Do you see why it matters? Do you believe it does? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a warning that the United States has fallen behind in high-speed broadband internet access with economic implications that could be enormous. My guest tonight, Thomas Blea, has a big article in the current Foreign Affairs. It's entitled Down to the Wire. Tom Friedman saw it and piled in saying, hey, what's going on here? The economic future is in trouble if the United States doesn't lead on this front. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is your style, your economic life, cramped by outdated internet access? Is the country's? And is this techno-alarmism, The Economist magazine says so? Or is it a real problem? Is internet innovation shifting to broadband leaders, to South Korea and Japan, away from the United States? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Blea, there's a bunch of basics I want to get into here. But first, just if listeners were sitting in Tokyo or Seoul tonight and they got on the kind of internet access that's so common there now, would they see a clear difference? Do we see a very different style of interaction, a very different speed that people use?
Oh, absolutely. If you were a young person in Seoul, for example, you might well be sitting in an internet cafe involved in a very elaborate internet game that involves a team of maybe 10 or 12 people sitting in your internet cafe playing against a team elsewhere in Korea or elsewhere in the world with cheers and this and that. Video and interaction are the great benefits of real wide bandwidth.
And you're saying the U.S. is even further behind in wireless mobile phone-based internet access.
We are indeed. I might just say that we were in 13th place at the end of 2003, but by the end of last year, 2004, we had dropped three more places to 16th place.
So you're updating us in real time here, and it doesn't look prettier as we go.
No, and we almost dropped to 17th because France came in, a normal technological laggard came in very close behind us.
Okay, so you're making the case that the hugest fruits of the Internet age are going to come with very broadband access where you can do all kinds of things online that we could only dream about when it was the dial-up connection. You're saying these countries are speeding ahead of the United States, and it's happened in a relatively small number of years. First of all, just in number terms or ratio terms, how much faster is the access, let's say, again, in South Korea or Japan, that's widely available there than what most Americans have? Give us a comparison.
Well, the typical broadband connection in Japan right now is 15 times faster than our typical broadband connection.
And what's the typical you're describing in the United States so people at home can
think about
their own connection?
The typical in the United States right now is a nominal 1.5 megabits per second.
And is that a cable connection or DSL or dial-up?
That's a DSL connection or a cable connection.
Okay. 1.5, what was that again?
And that 1.5 megabits per second.
Okay.
And that is not guaranteed by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. It may be half that.
So in the U.S., that's a good speed.
That's a typical
context,
speed.
Typical.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a typical speed. Now, in Japan, a typical speed is 25 megabits per second.
Wow.
About 15 times faster.
And what kind of applications, therefore, are coming down the line in Japan that you just won't see in the U.S., or what kind of applications may come down the line that won't happen here?
Well, they have access now to music videos, for example, realistic telecommuting is possible in that you can have a video. You can participate in a staff meeting at home and see other people on a screen. And
real video conferencing without the kind of jerky connection that we'd see.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's jerky here because it's a video streaming.
Right.
There it's... Anyway. Mm-hmm. So telecommuting. Mm-hmm. They are pushing telemedicine. That is where a doctor some hundreds of miles away can make a diagnosis or supervise an operation. They are talking about transportation, alerting people by cell phone and other ways to traffic jams, crowded trains, this sort of thing.
In other words, all the kind of transformational activities that people dream of with the web. Thomas Blair, why has this happened in Japan and South Korea? Why have they moved so quickly ahead in speed, and why hasn't the United States?
Well, in both countries, they looked to China and saw that China could manufacture enough for the entire world.
Enough what?
And enough of anything. Manufactured goods.
The same thing we're staring at.
The same thing we're staring at, but a little less close at home.
Mm-hmm.
So they took the notion of a knowledge economy seriously, and in 2000, in the case of Japan, they set forth a very bold plan with targets, including broadband, and they made it a top priority. They moved it into the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister and his entire cabinet comprised the IT strategic headquarters in Japan, and they've done some funding, and they followed through. So that's what basically did it.
With policies to encourage these high-speed connections, and not just in the urban centers, but right across the whole country, in Japan.
That's
South
right.
Korea.
They took this notion of universal broadband to heart. And they did it in two ways. For high-speed broadband, they had a very high target of 30. They wanted to reach 30 million households out of Japan's 46 million households in 5 years. And to do that, they set forth a very strict competitive regime and forced the regional telephone companies that controlled the copper wires that come to each of the Japanese homes and apartments to open them up to qualified outside competition. And when the telephone companies delayed and made it difficult for competition, the antitrust people stepped in and said, "Do this."
So they basically mandated it with a big Japanese-style top-down plan, and you say it's working. On the U.S. front, what's happened there? The U.S. created the Internet, and as you describe, had leadership in speed and just about everything else for a long time. Why not now? What's happened? Why hasn't the same explosion in speed of access taken place here?
Well, I would argue that at the top political level, at President Bush's level, in his top aides, they've been occupied with other things, as we know. I also believe that at the top economic levels of the government, as Tom Friedman pointed out in his article, we have a railroad man who's Secretary of the Treasury. And I don't believe they have a full understanding of the importance of information technology to economic growth. The Clinton-Gore people, in their last economic report, for example, attributed fully one-third of the American economic growth from 1995 to 2000 to information technology. So that's the second problem. And the third problem is that at lower levels, the officials, particularly at the FCC, but elsewhere, the Commerce Department and so forth, have believe in a market-led broadband deployment.
So why isn't the market bringing us high-speed broadband connections very widely?
Well, because they're not so interested in competing.
Who's
the telephone company? Mm-hmm. They being mainly the telephone companies, which have gone to court repeatedly and lobbied on the Hill to thwart this outside competition. And the cable companies have also not pitched in. The telephone companies in particular are concerned that the cable people may come up with telephone lines, telephone connections, and the cable people think the telephone people will come up with faster connections and maybe be able to bring in TV and movies and so forth and compete with them.
So in other words, the companies that have the access in their hands, the telephone American telephone companies and cable companies, have been the market's kind of been given to them, and you're saying they are actually disincented or feel that it may be not in their interest to give Americans greater speed to the web because it might produce more telephone competition, might bring more pirated video and all the rest?
It could. The competition is emerging. That's clear. The cable companies are now busy in many areas doubling the speed of their internet connection. That's so that they can provide reliable internet telephoning. On the other hand, the telephone companies in several locations throughout the country are now laying fiber optic cable to have fast internet connectivity, and they're talking about movies, providing movies and so forth. But there are endless legal battles and so forth. The cable people went to court the other day to say that the telephone companies, before they show any movies, do anything, they're going to have local access channels, this and that and the other thing. And we can't go to Congress because they're all divided up as well. And Michael Powell, the former or the FCC chairman who just stepped down, said that it wouldn't be a good idea to have new legislation, although in normal circumstances it would. The telephone companies and the cable companies, until rather recently, have been were fully regulated, as you know, and they have extremely good legal and lobbying staffs that they employ fully.
And they're protecting their interests, and the country's access to the web is slow. And Thomas Blair says that means real big long-term implications for the U.S. economically in terms of economic growth, increased productivity, better quality of life occurring over there. South Korea, Japan, even China, now more broadband, high-speed broadband users than the United States. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Thomas Blair, stand by. We're joined right now from San Francisco by Wade Rausch. He's a senior editor for Technology Review. He covers information technology. Wade Rausch, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So you've seen Thomas Blair's case. He lays it out. He says, look, we're up against competitors who have a very keen sense of where the future lies. They have they've laid out policy that's encouraged very high-speed internet connections, and it may sound like one small little issue in the economy, but it has enormous consequences. How do you see it, Wade Rausch? Are we getting behind the eight ball here in the land where the internet was born?
I certainly agree with the assessment that when you have really sort of coordinated government action to speed up innovation, it helps tremendously to get technology out into the population and get people using it. I think that both in Japan and Korea, there's been a concerted effort not just to create incentives for the phone companies to work on this technology, but the government itself has been involved in both countries in marketing, to some extent, the benefits of broadband to their people. And the people have been responding in droves. In Korea, for example, which is a sort of education-obsessed country to begin with, people are using broadband for distance learning and that kind of application to a much greater extent than you'll find here. So I think Mr. Blay is absolutely right to point out that the key role of government sort of attention and investment. On the other hand, I would say that we aren't necessarily lost here in the United States. It's certainly true that we're not getting much leadership from the Bush administration in this area, but I'm immersed every day in talking with and writing about folks from the private sector who are really doing some fascinating things with mobile technology and broadband technology right here in America. And I think there are some fascinating things going on that are going to be changing the way we work and live as well, and things that may wind up being adopted over in Asia. So I think it's a two-way conversation. One of the things that I'm pretty excited about right now, for example, is the effect of mobile communications on social software, social computing, or the whole phenomenon of blogging, for example. It's now possible to take a picture on your cell phone, upload that picture to your blog, tell all your friends about it, have them leave their own comments about that picture. It's a totally new way of communicating, something that hasn't quite happened yet in Japan to the same extent.
But if we're doing that more slowly, are we permanently disadvantaged, or at least for the foreseeable future, in applications like that and others? Wait.
I think that these things have cycles, and that we are certainly behind the curve right now in terms of the penetration of broadband into American homes, and in terms of how fast our cellular networks work and so forth. It tends to go back and forth, though. Once we realize that we've caught up, once we realize we're behind, thanks in part to analyses by people like Dr. Blay, we realize we need to catch up, and we do. It certainly happened in supercomputing, where a few years ago we looked up and said, hey, what do you know? Japan has built the world's fastest supercomputer. We used to dominate in that area, and maybe we should be reinvesting in that area. And the fact is, we're catching up, and very soon we'll surpass or already have surpassed Japan in terms of having the world's fastest supercomputers.
And now we've got an interesting arena where it requires pulling in millions of people to catch up. That may require a policy response. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call. Spiros is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Spiros. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a couple points. One was my agreement with the kind of stonewalling that the telecom companies have been putting up. And I had actually read an article a few months back about a city, and I want to say it was New Orleans, but I may be incorrect, that actually was going to try to lay the fiber optic for its own broadband connectivity in the city.
I think Philadelphia is looking at that.
And New Orleans was actually stonewalled and taken to court in some of these litigations by, I want to say it was one of the Bell companies.
Okay, we'll look at that.
To not allow them to put in their own fiber optic network because it was competition to them, to the telephone company. And to me, that's a frustrating proposition because as a consumer, you know, if I was living in a city that wanted to do that, I don't know.
That's when you say bring it on. Spiros, we've got it. Thomas Blay, what about the U.S.? Looking forward, how fast do you think the country can turn around this speed issue? Is it happening, or are we still relatively losing ground in terms of the speed of Internet access?
It depends. It depends on how quickly this competition develops between cable and DSL. I happen to believe it will occur more slowly than some believe. But I certainly agree with Mr. Rausch's point that all is not lost. We're behind. It's possible to catch up. But I believe that we're still basically drifting. And that to catch up, it will take some government action.
Government action in terms of restructuring markets or prodding providers.
It'll take government action to have more competition, to spur competition, and I think that when we begin talking about about fiber optic access, that we may have to think in terms of tax incentives and conceivably even subsidies in rural, uneconomic areas.
A whole lot that may need to happen to stay in the game, and a lot of it not happening right now. Thomas Blay in Washington, Wade Rausch in San Francisco. Please stick with us. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about a warning that the U.S. has fallen behind in broadband internet access, and the economic implications could be very large. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you believe that high-speed broadband is a key to the country's 21st century economic leadership? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a warning that the United States has fallen behind in broadband internet access with economic implications that could be huge. My guests tonight, Wade Rausch is with us. He's senior editor at the Technology Review, covers IT, joins us tonight from San Francisco. And Thomas Blea, author of the piece in Foreign Affairs, of all places, Down to the Wire, looking at how and why the United States has fallen behind in the portion of Americans who have high-speed or ultra-high-speed access to the web. Look to South Korea. Look to Japan. Look to 15 other countries that are now have much more widespread high-speed access. He says the implications of that are enormous. You can join the conversation tonight. Should the U.S. government lead here or get out of the way? Will the market fix this? And have you tasted the lightning-fast internet world of Tokyo or Seoul? Will the U.S. ultimately catch up? Will it prevail? And what if it doesn't? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Smokey is calling from Burlington, North Carolina. Smokey, that sounds fast.
Well, thank you for my call, taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I've heard examples about how internet cafes and people blogging and things like that, but I still fail to see the point in super high-speed internet being related to productivity in manufacturing and things like that. When we hear our economy is slowing down and we have a huge trade deficit,
yeah,
how is the internet going to help me produce a car quicker or, for the United States to get back on top economically or at least try and balance the trade deficit with productivity?
Right. So sort of connect the dots here, make the case that it's really got all that consequence. Smokey, we'll try and do that. Thomas Blea, first to you. Fill in some of the blanks here. Smokey looks and sees the internet, and he's not sure how that turns into productivity and competitive power.
Well, in both the United States and Japan right now, for example, Disney Studios and in Japan, the animation studios there are working on a global fashion. In Japan, for example, the animation that's done, I don't know if you saw or Smokey saw the movie Spirited Away,
and yes,
that won an Academy Award.
Very sophisticated, dense animation.
A very sophisticated movie. That was done by one of Japan's great animation people, and it was drawn in Japan. It was colored in Korea. And the English subtitles were provided for it in Singapore.
And all that was possible because
all
you're
of
saying
possible,
of ultra-high-speed internet connections.
Ultra-high-speed internet connections, that's right. And many, many design projects now are taking place in the same way. If you've taken a look at Tom Friedman's new book, The World is Flat, they're ready to do your taxes for you in India or read your X-ray or whatever else needs to be done.
So
right away.
There's some examples in entertainment and in services that can zip quickly here and there. Wade Rausch, how would you describe, for a layman, how the speed of the internet connection really adds heft to productivity, to economic clout? or country?
Well, there was a mention earlier of telecommuting, kind of a genuine opportunity to do anything from home that you can now do from the office, any kind of file management, building presentations, video conferencing, that sort of thing, which is very important in terms of, well, I guess it is productivity when you let people work 24 hours a day instead of just 8 hours a day.
Or slavery, one or the other.
Smokey asked about, you know, how is this going to build me a better car? Well, the kinds of things that Mr. Blair was talking about with regard to the animation studios are extremely valuable in automotive design as well, and General Motors and other companies have invested a lot in being able to collaborate across distances. With such a globally distributed company, you need to be able to bring your engineers together to work on designs together, and they're building what they call collaboratories to share two-dimensional and three-dimensional models and basically design the car in the computer before they ever have to produce it. And that sort of stuff would be very difficult without high-speed internet connections of the sort that the government pioneered in the 80s and 90s. We're not getting that leadership anymore, so it is a kind of question mark whether industry will pick up the baton.
So design, communication, coordination, and clearly entertainment. There's a lot you can do and move over high-speed connections. Thomas Blair, I want to ask, I thought the message that came out of the 90s was that we had developed this tremendous overcapacity of optical fiber, capacity, and now you're saying we don't have enough. Which is it, or am I confused on that front?
Well, you're quite correct. As a result of the dot-com bust, we have an extraordinary amount of fiber that's been laid, enough to reach the sun, as a matter of fact. Unfortunately, only about 97% of it is not being used.
And why not? It's not hooked up to anything? What's the problem?
Exactly. It's the superhighway with no on or exit ramps.
Because it doesn't go from house to house to house to store to
that's
factory?
Right. That's right. The fiber has simply been laid. There's still a lot of hard work to do to put the switches on it and bring it to homes or to take it to wireless points to get to homes and offices. And also, it not surprisingly, it tends to go to big cities, not to the countryside. And our overseas links were also greatly strengthened during that period.
So it's easy to ship work off to India and China, but not necessarily to ship it to Peoria or a small town.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another call. Clint is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Clint. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to touch on a few points, and then I have a question.
Yeah.
I feel that one of the fundamental and perhaps perpetual reasons that Japan, I'm not so sure about Korea, I'm more knowledgeable about Japan, but that they have the advantages, it's a matter of logistics. You're talking about Japan as a country that roughly the size of California.
Yep.
You have 90% of the population, from what I've read, that lives in or around the Tokyo area.
Well, and much more densely packed in any case across the country, certainly, yeah.
Correct. And I think that this lends itself to very, very efficient and fast proliferation of any new technology. And this is something that I see as, in many ways, being a perpetual advantage. I don't know if we can ever compete with that type of speed simply because creating that type of infrastructure in the United States where most, you know, outside of New York and California perhaps, most people live in areas where that type of technology is not readily available.
And don't live so close to one another. We've got Montana and Texas-sized states to deal with.
I mean, Texas alone is larger than the entire country of Japan.
Right.
You have to think that creating that type of infrastructure in the U.S. is a massive, behemoth of an undertaking.
Yeah. Okay. We take your point. And your next one, Clint?
Yes. I was very, from the short time that I spent in Japan, I was very impressed by the use of this high-speed internet connectivity in mobile technology.
Cell phones and cameras and the rest.
Exactly, because they have such a smaller amount of ground to cover in terms of infrastructure, they were able to deliver two-way simultaneous video and, you know, live streaming music, anything. And I was wondering, first of all, how does this give the Asian markets an advantage in terms of business? How does this give them an edge over us? And in the long term, what kind of strategies would either of you suggest in that America could take to take advantage or put into place these types of systems?
Okay, we'll pick it up. Clint, thanks for your call. Wade, let me come first to you here on just the physical size. I mean, the United States is much larger than Japan or South Korea. The population is very much more spread out. Does that mean that the pace at which we're getting broadband connections around the country is reasonable given our larger scale?
Well, I think it's an excuse for not being caught up with countries like Japan and South Korea, but I think at the same time, it should be more of an incentive. It should be driving us to invest all the more heavily in getting connectivity out to the home. There are companies like Verizon and SBC that are investing in getting fiber to the home, as they call it. Very frequently, there's fiber to the curb,
right,
especially in urban areas, but mm-hmm. and that sort of solves the last mile problem. But then mm-hmm. there's the last 20 feet, getting from the curb into the home. So there are experiments of that nature here and there. I think that Mr. Blais is absolutely right that we don't have the right structure of incentives to get those connections into every home, and we need to work all the harder because we are such a giant nation.
Thomas Blair, what would the incentives be, to your mind, that would change the pace of dissemination of this high-speed connection in the United States? If you were, you know, king of the mountain, what policy would you put in place?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is to have do everything we can to spur competition. I think that's something that the Bush administration, the FCC, everyone can agree on that.
And be more specific, because we've already got hypothetically competition between phone companies and cable companies, and you say that's not working. So, how would you kick it up?
Well, I think that you need to encourage the power companies to get into the game. You need to encourage the wireless companies, the fixed wireless companies, to get into the game. You need to assert federal government authority so that Verizon doesn't tackle Philadelphia, for example, when they want to put up Wi-Fi around the city. As you may know, as a part of that deal, the state of Pennsylvania, the rest of the state of Pennsylvania is off limits for this kind of Wi-Fi thing, and the Texas legislature is also studying this issue, as far as I know.
How do you get the power companies and the wireless companies to become more active? Are you talking about government tax breaks, incentives, or
exactly? I think that this is something that President Bush mentioned. I think that that's what should be done. And it's a budgetary matter, of course, how much you can do, but tax incentives by all means. And open competition from cities, anything that will spur competition. On the ultra high speed side, on laying fiber cable and those on and off ramps, I think that that we'll really have to think about tax incentives and maybe even subsidies in rural areas.
Incentives to individual citizens to pay for
that? No. This would be again tax incentives to corporations to lay fiber,
right?
Or fixed wireless perhaps subsidize a bit satellite coverage so that we get the whole country. Clint's earlier point about being a large country, I mean, that's just our destiny, and that's, of course, a great advantage in many cases as well.
Mm-hmm.
Canada, another large country, had faced the same problem, and they worked out a way to cover the entire country with something like basic broadband, about twice as fast is our typical broadband connection now. And that's the second largest country in the world.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the population, as you well know, in Boston is huddled pretty closely to the American border.
Yes,
but still, there are outposts that had to be taken into account.
So right next door, very large, and it's working there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Aaron is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have to take issue with the doctor's fact that he believes there's a real market failure here. As an economist, I don't see strong barriers to entry, and I definitely have to take issue with the call for subsidies, which is basically taxpayers funding this type of broadband initiative when what we really see is the consumer demand simply isn't there, and there are very few barriers to entry to broadband right now, where that most American consumers who really want it and demand it have ample opportunity to get the broadband we currently have.
So as an economist, you don't like it because it looks like a big expense, it's unnecessary. You're saying let the market do it, Aaron.
Absolutely.
But what do you say, Aaron, about the fact that, by the numbers, the market hasn't done it so far? The U.S. is falling lower and lower in the ranking of widespread high-speed connections. What does that say to you?
Well, I have to agree with the article in The Economist, which said that this is an over-alarmist point of view. This type of thing has to be driven by consumer demand, and if we put in place large government subsidies and tax incentives, such as Japan and South Korea have done,
yeah,
these are not necessarily wanted and demanded by consumers in the U.S. at this point. What we're doing is creating a solution for which no problem exists. Now, when consumers begin to demand this and want these super fast internet connections, there are ample companies who are ready and willing to provide this. And like you mentioned, there is a massive fiber optic glut in cabling in the U.S., and it's just waiting to be used. So this opportunity, this will develop when consumers demand it. That just isn't happening yet.
We've got it, and thanks very much for your call, Aaron. Thomas Bleha, your response.
Well, I think that's precisely the question. How urgent is this? And I think you could that debate undoubtedly took place when they did the interstate highway system as well. It went through people's backyards and so forth, and people said repeatedly that, you know, we just don't need this.
A lot of disruption.
And then suddenly when it was in place, there were many needs, trucks going back and forth. It changed our way of life, as you know.
So I think that's a great example. We didn't wake up to the power of interstate freeways until we saw what the Germans had done with the Autobahn. And I think that to some extent there's a chicken and egg problem here, where once people see what can be done with this technology, there would be a demand. But unfortunately, most Americans have never gotten a chance to go over and experience the kind of connectivity and the kinds of services that are available to folks in South Korea and Japan these days.
And what about the cost-benefit ratio here, Thomas Blay? Our caller Aaron suggesting this is cost a lot. Consumers aren't voting with their feet at this point, so just wait. Is it worth the cost of the tax incentives and the rest that you've outlined?
Well, I think, first of all, that the notion of how much we're talking about here. One estimate that I've heard recently is that it would take about $100 billion to provide a ultra-high-speed connection for virtually all Americans. So that's the big number we're talking about.
And the trade-off you're talking, I see one number you've got is something like $1 trillion with a benefit over the next decade.
That's right. Those are economist estimates. I took them because that's what was available. It's also true that we're going to spend, again, according to a former FCC chairman, we're going to spend something like $400 billion over the next 5 years for simply the telephones and the internet connections and the cable modem connections and the cable connections that we already have.
So if we're going to spend a lot of money,
he can take this money right out of the middle of that, and everybody will be happy.
Spend it on ultra high speed and stay in the game. Well, different views here, but you've given us a big picture tonight. Thomas Bleha, we're very grateful to you for joining us. Thanks for your piece in Foreign Affairs down to the wire, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thomas Bleha, former U.S. Foreign Service officer. Look for his book on internet leadership coming out soon. And Wade Rausch, senior editor at Technology Review, joining us tonight from San Francisco. Very good to have you, Wade. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums if you've got a connection. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.